Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to listeners old and new. I'm Graham Hunter. You can get an extra big interview plus a documentary special every month and hear all our content free of adverts by signing up as a socio at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. This month, only socios get my big interview with Kev Kilbane. For £2.99 per month, you'll also know you're supporting our show. More at patreon.com/Graham Hunter. Thanks to all our socios. We need your help to do this. We couldn't and wouldn't do it without you. It's time for round two with Paul Dickov in the big interview. Finally, Manchester City fans, finally you're going to hear about Main Road, that playoff final, Oasis, and what Paul finds most thrilling about this current version of Manchester City. If you're not a City supporter, I still think you'll be interested in a glimpse of a point in that club's history not so long ago when they were seconds away from another season in the third tier. If a certain Scottish striker, yes, initials PD, doesn't score, Gwyneth Paltrow never meets John Hannah, and perhaps Pep Guardiola never finds Phil Foden either. Okay, you have to watch films to understand that sliding doors reference. Before all that, I want to explain a little bit about what Paul is up to now. He mentors kids in the schools run by the Loras Trust, that's in the Manchester area. The Loras Trust targets sporting as well as academic excellence, and Paul talks to children and teachers in groups or one-on-one about managing sporting development, diet and nutrition, plus laying pathways that give kids at these free schools the best possible chance of being all they can be. Do find out more at lorastrust.co.uk. You'll be interested. Well, you need to tell me how many days we'd need to cover you and Manchester City. So let's try and be selective. In fact, you can, if we're dancing, you can lead on this one. I know what I'm interested in, and I want to take it in reverse a little bit, because, and if any stage I go into a blind alley and you say, no, I've got more important or interesting things to tell you, then just say so. Yeah. This is your podcast. When we arrived here, the taxi driver, our taxi driver, jumped out and wanted a photo with you. You know, you're literally loved and adored. Mm. If I hadn't been for that Aguero, then you were the Scottish Aguero. We're joking,
I celebrated that goal more than I did my own one.
I bet you probably did. The thing I want to do is I want to go back to Automatismos and think about Wembley in 99. Yeah. And tell me if you don't remember, but I'm sure you've watched it often enough. But as you're playing Gillingham, which, you know, you must have been asked a billion times, the thing that stands out to me is not necessarily that it's a chum of yours in goals or that it's quite a big moment for the club. I don't know who the Gillingham defender is that gets into the GOAT, and between him and Sean, the ball comes to you like a wet baby seal.
He's still claiming.
I was an assist to go. You see, I need respect saver.
Grasping it.
Didn't look like that to me. Sean, sorry. But the ball rockets at you. Mm-hmm. And if it was a fluke, you can tell me. And if you don't remember, you can tell me. But your touch is just sublime. It's velvet. Mm-hmm. And it's off the inside cushion of your right foot just to give you a little bit of room for the shot. You've got no reaction time. And it's a beautiful touch. And if you want, we'll talk about the nicknames. I don't know how many nicknames you've got. Yeah. Is there a list quite long? And
probably that we couldn't.
Some of them are pesky.
Some we probably couldn't say.
I would have said Silky.
Yeah.
You know, that touch was gorgeous.
I've been called a lot of things, and I've been called silky before, I tell you.
Well, it was a silky touch. Yeah. Am I overselling the moment, or can you remember the moment, or could you go back to it and think about it?
I've had this conversation with loads of people saying, can you remember the goal? Can you remember the celebration? Did you plan it? I can't remember anything about it.
Nothing.
It's just, but I put it down to practice.
Yeah.
And training, and I went through a stage that season. Well, I went through a lot of stages in my career where I couldn't hit an iron door. And I was struggling in front of goal, and Joe, the gaffer, he worked with me, and I'd done little things after training with the ball.
It was Joe Royal, who'd been a big striker himself for Everton and Man City.
Absolutely, and what a manager, and what a guy as well. And we worked at it. You know, a lot of it was firing the ball into me, touch, hit. I even came up with this little thing. If I was shooting and training, I was doing my thing. And sometimes I would say, I'll go touch it. Ball was coming quicker, I'll go touch it. All the time in my head, in my head, in my head. And when it went into games, I look back a lot of my goals. After that, a lot of it was very similar with the thing in my head. Da, 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 da. And I can only imagine that's what happened with the goal. Mm. It's come into me, practice it loads in training, touch it, hit the target.
It's a brilliant explanation, and you don't remember it, but if the way I've described it, you must have looked at it again.
I've watched it a couple of times.
I haven't described it falsely.
Yeah.
And I'm hoping you're not going to be modest there. It was exactly what you've touched on about, like the kill the pace or don't, or hit it first time, Joe, and you in the practice. It is a good touch.
Yeah, it was.
You know, and at a moment as well, I know you don't remember it, but there was a lot of pressure in that moment.
Yeah.
You're not aware of it in the instant, probably.
No, it was just, I'd missed a chance just before it that Vince...
Had he saved it rather than you missed it?
Yeah, he pulled off a good save.
And Vince, apparently, I didn't know this at the time, was your... Yeah.
I was Vince's best man, and me and Jan, my wife, are godparents to him.
It's a Terry Venables George thing all over again, isn't it, really?
Exactly.
Okay.
But, yeah, I've watched it back, and, you know, it was a good touch, and it was a decent finish as well. You know, Vince takes some stick about it, and I give him some stick as well, because it looks as if he's pulled his hand away a little bit, which obviously he's not.
Come on, I'd say not.
And get it in, but... As well.
Does it take a? It doesn't take a touch.
Nah, don't be stupid.
No, so definitely. Yeah. Wait, no. The audio is failing here. Are you clear on whether it did or didn't?
It definitely didn't.
I knew that anyway. I just
but Vince had saved before, and what a lot of people don't realise, when Gillingham went 2-0 up, Tony Pulis took off his two best players, two centre forwards, Carlos Abba and Robert Taylor, who were probably the best, apart from me and the goat, and strike partnership in the division. You know, they were lethal. They'd both scored in the game and were really dangerous. And at 2-0, Tony took them off. And I remember looking at a lot of the Gillingham players high-fiving each other, congratulating each other, even when Kevin Orlock scored in the 89th minute. And I'm thinking to myself, I remember the one thing I do remember on the pitch, that we're going to get another chance here. And that team had come back.
That's in your head. That's actually echoing around your head. We'll get another chance here.
Yeah.
Love that.
That team had came back loads of times to score late on in games that season as well. And I just had a feeling. At 2-0, I was devastated. I was on my haunches, Wembley. Dream shattered, playing at Wembley, scoring at Wembley, the build-up to the club's
record. Had you trod the grass before?
No, first time.
Probably never been a tartan on your man either.
Well, no, I'd been there with Arsenal as a squad player, but never actually played in the pitch. Mm-hmm. You know, and it went from devastation, all your dreams are shattered, to... being the lucky little shit that scored the equaliser to take it into extra time.
Not luck, hard work. Let me ask another one that plays into all of that. You'd prepared for the playoff in the city of Manchester, where it must have pissed everybody off that there was a carnival going on.
Yep.
And Manchester United had won the treble in the most extreme 95th minute.
The Wednesday before.
Circumstances. Yeah. Did people talk about that in the city dressing room?
We didn't, as players. No, we were just so focused. And, you know, talking about big characters at Arsenal, we had a lot of characters in that team as well. You know, and Joe was brilliant at managing the individuals, because there was all sorts, and there was ways and strays from everywhere, do you know what I mean? And Joe just had this brilliant knack of managing all individually brilliantly and putting his into a team.
Different strokes for different folks.
Yeah, but when it came to the togetherness and everything else, he knew how to do that as well.
Did you watch the game, the United game in the Camp Nou?
I did, I watched it at home.
Do you think the rest of them did?
I don't know.
It's just an irrelevant, it was a blip.
Yeah, we just didn't, probably because we didn't want to think about it. you know. But fair point of view from the blue side of Manchester, that week building up to the game was massive. You know, people queuing days to get tickets for Wembley, and the position the club was in at that time.
The club had never been in the third tier before.
They hadn't, and it shouldn't have been. Well, it was complete mismanagement before. Mm-hmm. You know, and talking about Joe's man management, when Joe first came in, I think there was 56 pros.
56
in the club. Yeah, I mean from the end of August, September, when I signed for City, to the January, I had five different managers.
Yeah,
which is just ridiculous. You know, and you think about it. I signed for Alan Ball. Mm-hmm. God bless him. On the Friday, on the Sunday, he loses his job, and I'm thinking, cheers, thanks for that.
Nice one.
Yeah, Asa Hartford and Steve Coppell for 39 days.
Steve wasn't keen on the job, he went quickly.
Yeah.
On his own volition.
Then Phil Neal. Well, actually, then Frank Clark came in the January, so six managers the club had. Mm-hmm. And what had happened, every manager that came in, they allowed them to bring in their own players.
Nobody was overseeing it.
No, so when Joe comes in, he's got 56. When you think Premier League squads are 25 now.
Mm-hmm. And really elite managers talk about wanting short squads.
Yeah.
Because it's easier to, okay, with injuries. The elite managers probably want about 19 players with a chance to take 4 or 5 kids.
Kids, yeah. There's no chance for any of the kids to
56.
Come in. There was, honestly, at the Platt Lane, at the old training ground, there was three different first-team changing rooms. You know, there was the ones that Joe wanted to keep, the ones that he probably wanted to keep but couldn't afford to keep, and the ones he wanted to let go.
Whoa.
And to manage that situation,
the atmosphere,
and bring stuff up, poison.
Oh.
At times, you know, and
because it's impossible to get unity of purpose and unity of feeling there.
Of course it is. Of course it is. But not when it's like that. Not when you've got a group of players who have been told that they don't want to be. I'm not talking about 2 or 3.
Yeah, you're talking about 23.
Yeah. Yeah, and for Joe,
I didn't know that.
I look back and after sort of managing myself, you realise how brilliant he was at doing that. You know, I remember having a conversation with Johnny's office at Platt Lane and him telling me that Wigan wanted to sign me, that he didn't want me to go. He loved having me there, he loved what it was about, but he had to, it was simple, he needed to try and get some money in, and he needed to trim his squad. And I was one of the few players that he'd offers for. What did I think? And I went, are you being honest with me and saying that you want to keep me? And he went, yeah. I said, well, I'll stay.
Wow, there's a sliding doors thing right there. This isn't season one.
Yeah.
Because by the end of that season, you're going to score against Wigan in the semi-final, put them out and go to Wembley.
That's right, yeah. Season before.
So you, but in that discussion, even though you've said to Joe, I challenge you, you tell me the truth here, football is based, without being rude, football is based on a lot of untruths.
Well, bullshit.
And double dealing. Yeah. And bullshit. It is. And if we don't, but say that, then we're lying.
But I just felt.
But you have to take that risk. I go back to your dad.
Absolutely.
When he says, as long as you're doing your best, because you've taken a risk on Joe, you don't know him that well.
Yeah.
He could be selling a line, and you could be sitting as player number 32 because he hasn't got everybody out in 6 months' time. But you've been brave enough to go,
I have, and
I'm going to trust you.
I back myself.
Yeah.
I thought, if he's going to give him the opportunity, I'll show him. And do you know what? If it doesn't, and don't forget, there was no transfer windows then, so he could move a majority of the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so if he does give him the opportunity and I show him and it still doesn't happen, there'll still be something else there. If I don't get the opportunity, there'll still be something else there. But at least he's willing to give me this chance and I'll show him.
Again, then I'm going to test you a little bit, because the penalty shootout that you've earned for City, Gillingham don't do particularly well in it, but your kick must have ticked you off, because it's hit every part of the woodwork and not gone in.
Honestly.
Against Vince again.
I've never been as confident in my life of taking a penalty.
Seriously.
The week leading up to it, and the Wigan game, because the two-legged Wigan game, because it was tight and the one at Main Road, we knew who was taking the penalties. Joe had us prepared. We knew who was 1, 2, 3,
it was a list.
4, 5. We
were and
taking them after day.
Wow.
In training, everything else.
Are you a believer in that? Because I've seen it all in my time.
I am, yes, but exact same as I wanted to do finishing on a Friday. You know, for me, I needed to do that. Mm. Other people, maybe not. You know, I do think it's a completely individual thing.
Did you care where you came in the order of 5?
I was honestly, I was so confident to the point. The 3 days leading up to, I'd stayed out with Nicky Weaver, and I would say Weaves, because it's helping him as well. I'm going to put the ball there, but don't cheat, don't dive early. But you know where it's going. He couldn't save one of them.
Wow.
Every penalty I took,
you're hitting the side panel.
And I'm telling him where I'm putting it as well. So when I've made that walk to go up to take the penalty in my head, I was like, bang. Joe used to say, you're like a tennis machine.
Brilliant. But looking back at the penalty now, without trying to get you off the hook, because, spoiler, City win, where it strikes that right-hand post, there's two reasons it should go in. At that angle, it probably should just go straight into the opposite side panel. And the way it moves, they should catch, you know, Vince's heel and go in, to be honest with you.
It was. I was devastated. You know, it wasn't until so confident.
That's why I'm asking this question, because you didn't look devastated. Not one instant.
Oh, I was.
You looked as if you were an office worker who dropped his pen. And you go like this. And because the guy before you took Gillingham's first one, and he's missed, and he's got his head in his hands. It's the scream by Munch. But, and
you know what, Graham? Probably the reason I didn't do that was because I knew we were still level.
That's what I'm talking about, mentality.
Inside.
I might be giving too much into this, but he told everybody, Gillingham, his coach, the other players, we're doomed.
Yeah.
And you were like, I'm ticked off. And you walked back and you got a big embrace from the fellas when you were back there. But you were walking back there, no big deal, right? It's all under control. I'm not weeping tears. I think in the tension of a moment, when your teammates who aren't as sure as you they're going to hit the net, I think you've done them a wee favour there.
Yeah, and I had every confidence in the lads that were going up as well. What helped me, well, I'm saying helped me, because obviously they've missed theirs. Kevin Orlock scored. Mm-hmm. They've missed. I've missed. So we're still... pressure's still on them. And then they missed the next one. So from the time it took me to walk back for the penalty spot and then walking up and taking it, every emotion possible. I actually celebrated them missing the penalty probably just as much as I did scoring my goal, because I knew I was off the hook.
Yeah, whatever happens now, I'm home.
You know, and then Richard Edgehill scored. So you know it's your day when Richard Edgehill scores any sort of goal.
I'm not aware of Richard's reputation technically, but I'm beginning to gauge that you feel that
Brilliant. Maybe
that was his big moment technically.
Yeah, it was.
Okay.
Yeah, Richard. Just about.
Well, he loved the club. He kissed
the match. He did. He did, and you're top boy.
And then did Nicky practice that run? You know, could he do it with a ball at his feet?
I've never seen one run ever.
And he's fast.
And two as quick as that.
He's fast. And he's dribbled past photographers and up the stand and down again.
Do you know what? I thought I was going to have to get a defib out. I swear to God, because he's ran that much, right? And I was the last one, because I... probably too nice. I went to see Vince straight away. And do you know what? He would have done the same thing as well.
Yeah. That's proper friendship.
And... the big galoots running around Wembley.
That's a brilliant word. So, that's the first time in about 52 interviews we've had the word galoot. I love that.
But all the lads are on top of Nicky by the time I get
there's a big pile up.
So I'm the last one.
Yeah.
And I've went down, I went like that, and I swear to God, it was a... I thought it was a screaming pig in the ground. He couldn't breathe. He was that knackered, because it's the only time and the quickest he's ran in his life. And,
but
brilliant. And do you know what? Just Don Reeves, it's a... He would have been England's goalkeeper, I have no doubt about it, if he hadn't had his injuries.
So he's a character, Richard's a character.
They all were.
Help me a little bit, because, you know, you've played with somebody you loved here for various different reasons, and I suppose it's your part in the promotions, your devotion to the cause, your ability, your goals, attitude. Also, fans know who they like, I think. But there were others. Kinky?
Georgie could not make you with your legs closed. Unbelievable ability. Talking about saying about crying shame about ways. He should have played at a top club, but he'd probably admit himself that his attitude wasn't the best on a day to day basis.
Or at night.
Yeah, or at night, or away at Southend on a Tuesday night. You know,
mentality. If you could have grafted a little bit of
great kid, but just. As in applying himself as he should have done, you know, and maybe without speaking to, I've seen him about 6 months ago, I think it was, in depth about it, it's probably a regret he's got now.
When you talk about his ability, I mean, he genuinely was a magician.
He was a little git, honestly. He would take the piss out of you in training. You knew what he was going to do, but you couldn't get anywhere near him.
That's something in football where you know what somebody's going to do, you can't stop it.
He was so talented, and it's just such a shame. I know he went to Ajax and it didn't work out, but...
And he did have a sort of real cult status here. Was there a kind of fit between the club and the fans and the attitude and the sort of idea of Manchester City and Kinky at that time? Even Kinky?
He probably shouldn't have got him in the first place, you know, for the player he was and where the club won his Premier League when they signed him. But he was a phenomenal talent. He really was.
George Weah?
George was brilliant. Most came here, World Player of the Year. So humble. You know, you're sitting on, I remember, I think his first game was Stockport pre-season. You know, and I was...
Even as you say, George, we had Stockport way pre-season.
Yeah, it was. And
it's there's something not quite...
You know, and we're on the coach, and I can remember sitting there and thinking, okay, that's George Weah. Just sort of sitting there with his headphones on. What is going on here? And then Joe named the team, and it was a pre-season game. He went up front, and Dickie and George. I'm thinking, this is surreal. You know, it was mental, but didn't quite work out for him, I think.
Had injuries or age taken a toll, or could you see in training what he was? Or
yeah.
Something?
Yeah, you could tell in training. His first touch was just insane, before silky, and how he moved, and little dribbling, and strength. Maybe that yard of pace that he used to have had gone a little bit. For whatever reason, it didn't quite work out. I sort of tell a slightly different story. The week he left, we played Bradford at home, and Joe, I'd been in the bench, put George in the bench and started me, and I think George thought, and Dick was playing ahead of me, I've gone.
I just give up now.
We played Bradford, I think we won 2-0, 2-1, I scored, and George left the week after. But what a brilliant, brilliant guy. You know how, with young Jim Whitley, Jeff Whitley, a lot of youngsters in the school.
Coming through from the ranks, he was thought of.
And for them to train with him, but see how he handled himself, you know, there was no ego, no attitude, no nothing. It was just, the short time, we know him, everybody will tell you the same thing that was here at that time. Just.
And he's got a political life now, I think, so.
Very intelligent.
When we had a benefit, big interview for a cancer hospice in Port Glasgow, Neil Lennon was our guest, and he told a tale of being at Crewe and moving here and playing for City and falling into bad company with Steve Lomas, I think.
Lomas.
And being invited on a VIP backstage ticket to, I think, an Oasis gig at
Main Road.
And the two of them being overexcited and getting absolutely stocious together as great mates and turning up at the gig and for some reason falling out in the tunnel leading up to the VIP area, battering Seven Shades out of each other. As
Lenny
and Lomi could do that sober, but this time it was mega, it was nuclear. And they are being huckled, pissed, away from the goal line of the VIP room as Noel looks at them and says, lads, none of that behaviour around us. Which has got to be, you know, you've really got it wrong.
Yeah, you've overstepped the mark when they're telling you that.
Have you interacted with the Gallagher brothers and is Oasis Baltic of Man City a thing?
Oasis Man City is definitely a thing, a big, big thing as well. You know, I remember, and it was at Main Road, can't remember who were playing, Noel and Liam, what was it, the sort of when they were just hitting the big time. Two completely different characters, get on well with both of them. And they've walked out onto the pitch, been announced, Noel's walked, Calm Collective walked out and waved to the crowd. I think it was Portsmouth or something we were playing. And then it was, I think it was the first day of the season, it was about 30 degrees, you know, sweltering, 30,000 people there, and Liam's walked out with his Parker on, hood up, and the away fans have booed him, so well, Noel's giving it that, Liam's walked out onto the pitch, giving two fingers to all the away fans, and coming back off, which made us laugh. Seen Noel a lot at the games, especially a lot of the European games, we were in Madrid a couple of years ago for the semi-final. He's back, he's kindly invited me to his concert in March in Manchester.
I think I asked about them not for this stardust drop, but because, again, like Kinky, it feels to me that, you know, how they create, what their music's like, what their attitudes are like, and City, maybe not City today, but City that you grew up in, there's a kind of fit.
There is, and you know, no doubt it's sort of, it's helped both the club and Oasis at the time to have that connection.
Fair point. I can't leave this now without trying to get you to share a little bit about your enjoyment about what's happening at City at the moment. You're still a Celtic fan?
That's
gone, by the way.
Yeah.
You should really be a dyed-in-the-wool Arsenal fan. You should.
I have a soft spot.
But it's city for you, isn't it?
It is, and it's...
Sorry, will that be rude?
MD that...
Why?
Yeah, I've been asked this. But,
sorry.
You know, at that time where, you know, the people laugh at the pinned tweet in my Twitter, and it's like, my kids used to ask me, where were you when you were shit? But why did the fans sing that? And I used to say to the kids, I was playing. You know? And that is a true story. We were at the game at the Etihad. City fans are singing, where were you when you were shit? And my boys have asked me, why are they singing that? And I was like, well, because that's when I was playing. Sort of, and we were, by the way, for a majority of it. The club... I'm not going to speak on behalf of the GOAT and Kevin Orlock and Nicky Weaver and all the players around that time. If you ask them, they'll probably tell you that they're City fans now as well. The supporters are phenomenal. There's no supporters like them. I know people give them stick now saying they're jumping on the back of the success and everything else. That's bullshit. You know, I remember going to Port Vale away on a Tuesday night, Colchester's old ground on a Tuesday night, York City away, and Man City fans taking over the place and backing you to the hilt. And it actually seemed the worse we got as a team and the further we went down, the better the supporters.
You've got right to the heart of what we think about football in Britain there, haven't you?
Yeah.
You know, backs against the wall, the worse it gets, the more we unify.
100%.
We'll take over little grounds, not in a violent way, but like, we're here, we're for you,
not just
we're
the
noisy.
Grounds, the cities.
Yeah.
You know, I guarantee there was more Man City fans than the home fans.
Not every fan would have noticed this going on around them.
No,
and some people turn up for the paycheck, do their best, and go away, irrespective of that fan support.
And you know, and it's an old cliche, and it sounds a little bit cheesy, but we did as a team, or I would come out and say, or Andy Morrison, or the big characters, and say, look, you've seen them out there. Mm. They're here for us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go and give them something back.
Mm.
And but the club, it got a hold of me. It's hard to explain.
It's a perfect answer.
And I think
don't we all wish, whoever's listening to this, that we had something like that in our lives?
Yeah.
It won't always be Man City.
Yeah.
It won't always be football or sport.
Absolutely.
But don't you want something to take hold of you and your soul and give your life a little bit extra spice and meaning?
And even look, I'm doing a lot more work off the pitch for the club now, and I love it. I love, and I just said the other day, then somebody said, I love working for the club. I love, you know, it's great. And especially the way the club is now, and I'll tell you something about the owners as well. They are fantastic, because it would have been so easy to come into the club and clear everything and change everything. You know, there's, I don't know numbers wise, but there's a lot of people working at the club now in big jobs, proper jobs within the club that were at Main Road. So they've made sure that they've, the club's wanting to be the best, massive globally, winning things and everything else, but they've made sure they've kept the core of the club here, and I think that's something that's quite special.
And in doing so, an attempt to, because the owners don't need to win these employees over, to keep something of the character or the soul?
The character, the soul, and the core of the club, and that relationship that Manchester City have always had with their supporters is still there.
Then it's inevitable we must also, I don't want to move off the owners. Yeah. If there's more to say, you feel free.
Yeah, absolutely.
But clearly the thing that is intriguing to me is that I watched Pep Guardiola do what he did at Barcelona, and particularly the first year where it was so rapid, where it was so dynamic, where it was so challenging to so many people, and the squad was in a different shape than it was when he probably reached his absolute peak in 2011 at Wembley against Manchester United. And therefore, partly because of Neil and Martin publishing Marty Perrineau's books, and because Bayern Munich is an interesting institution to me, I followed that quite a lot too. But I got very chippy, I have to admit. I got very chippy about ex-pros and managers in this country just saying, Pep can't, not here. Yeah. Not here, won't work, give up, that's stupid, we know better. When we were at the height of that debate, not knowing what you see now this season, where were you mentally? Where were you as a footballer? What was your perspective on that debate and on what Pep was trying to do?
I know it's easy in hindsight for me to say I always think that he would have got it right, but I did, and I've on record as saying that at the time. Some of the, if I go back to the summer, and people are asking me about what do I think about Man City last season and the up and coming season, and I said then that I seen some of the best football last season from Pep's team that had seen from not just a Man City team, but from any Premier League team in some of the games, in a majority of the games that they played. Now, yes, there was obviously things wrong that they've addressed in the summer. Otherwise, they wouldn't have finished trophyless at the end of the season. But there were signs with the squad they had last year that the football they were playing were brilliant. And they didn't quite get the rub of the greens in certain big games. You know, I remember the Chelsea game, for example, at the Etihad, when David Luiz should have been sent off. You know, in a different game altogether. And then Kevin De Bruyne misses from a yard out, you know, to make it 2-0, I think it was at the time. There was huge defining moments that season. You know, Tottenham game ended up drawing 2-0. Raheem's 2-0 up. Raheem Sterling's clean through on goal. Kyle Walker, ironically, pushes him in the back. Penalty, 3-0. Doesn't give the penalty. Spurs go and score 2-1, but they're up against it. But some of the football they played last season was brilliant. And then you looked at the players that he brought in the summer, and I was lucky enough to go on the pre-season tour. And lucky enough to watch Pep train with the lads.
That is a privilege, because he's very private about the training.
And be in the environment of the hotels. And MD that was on that trip will tell you that I could sense something special was happening. You know, and when myself and the great ambassador Mike Summerby were out there and we're watching the training, and then you've seen them. I know it's pre-season and it's pre-season games, but when they beat Madrid, and then beat Tottenham, it was just like watching a high intensified training session. Everything that they were doing on the training pitch was just translating naturally onto the football pitch. And you know, that's so difficult to do. It sounds simple and people think you should do it all the time. You know, I've played and I've managed, and for whatever reason in a game things don't happen in the training pitch that go on. But and even watching the games now, I think back to some of the things I've seen in the summer that I've seen that before. And it's because the work they do in the training pitch, world class players, they translate it onto the pitch.
You said an interesting thing that I want to pick up on then, because I remember, I won't name the Premier League club, but I did a favour for a manager. He said, come over, you can pick one of our players to interview and you can watch training. So I did. I saw them doing a rondo, which is the you'll see them here often in Barcelona. Do it in Spain and Madrid. It's very popular in Spain, and it was invented by Laureano Ruiz at Barcelona in the 70s, and it's a brilliant exercise in a number of different ways. But it was instituted at this Premier League club just as something of a joke. There was no intensity. The ball maybe got passed three times where somebody closed it down. Everybody's intention was that, you know, if you're in the circle rather than doing the doggy chasing, was to give a ball to your circle teammate, would get them in the middle rather than how long can we keep the ball. The training and intensity and doing so well in training that you can take it onto the pitch. You said you don't often, you know, it should be normal, but it isn't normal, is it?
Yeah, this isn't looking. The funny side of it, I was told when I became a manager that I'll soon realise that all footballers are thick. And it's so true, you know, and at a completely different level. I remember managing a game at Oldham where we were playing Swindon away. Swindon had just conceded, I think it was 12 goals from corners in the previous four games. So you're telling the players this, and you're saying set pieces. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, we didn't even train properly, we'd done set pieces. So everybody knew what they were doing, attacking, showing them videos of them conceding goals. This is where we're going to hit, this is the area where we're going to hit. So the last thing I said before we went out down at Swindon was, everybody know what they're doing for set pieces? Yes, Gaffer. I won't embarrass the kid by saying his name, I'll tell you later as well. 2 minutes into the game, we get a corner. And I'm like, here we go. You can tell their fans are...
Oh, no.
Yeah, their players even, you can tell. We're like, yeah. So the ball's in the... dug out your ball's in the far away corner flag. Ball's still in the corner flag. And I'm going... where?
Any chance?
It is. He'd forgotten he was taking the corner.
That's not right.
But do you know what he's doing? You know when people stand in the goalkeeper and barge into them, and
he's not in the same sharp.
And I had to go, and he's looked at me and I went, "You're taking the corner." And he went, "Sorry." No, but the knock
that's
on from,
extraordinary.
The knock on from that is I've then got the fans behind me going, "What have you done in training all week?"
Yeah, you
don't even
prepared?
Know what they're doing at the corners. So that's what I'm meaning, that you know. And I've played with players in Premier League level that
But is it also true that to try and avoid that kind of in one ear, out the other, you talked about Joe being really good at unifying and treating different cases differently. Do you bully them into paying attention, bullying them into doing what you're telling them to do, or is it a case of convincing? Or because I think this manager here is somebody who is very hard and will discard you at the right moment if you're not. Mm-hmm. But his intention is to be evangelical, to convince, to bring on side,
and to
engage them, and make them think, and make them believe, and show them why they're doing something.
I mean, looking from afar, and obviously,
I'm not asking the side to dress.
I've only had a couple of conversations with the manager when we were away, but the most impressive thing for me is not how they're playing, not how they press. You can just tell the players hang off every single word. Now, that's hard enough doing that at League One level. To do it with top world-class players, to have them, your De Bruyne's, your Silva's, your Aguero's, your Sané, you can go on and on and on. Mm-hmm. You can just tell that when they switch on like that. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of top players think they know it all. A lot of players that aren't top players that are playing the professional game think they know it all because they're professional footballers. Mm-hmm. But to have them switched on and hang off every single word is the most impressive thing for me.
Well, that's a great way to finish on City and Pep Guardiola, but I can't quite finish until I try to improve. See, I'm a generous giving guy, and I'd like to improve your summer experiences.
Okay.
Because I believe you're on record as saying that quite often you'll bump into ex-adversaries.
Yeah.
Who are like, oh, I'm staying away from them if there's a game of beach football or something like that, and they're scared of talking to you because you were... It wasn't personal in the first place on the pitch, was it? It wasn't
Never.
Personal, and it's not the real you.
Nowhere near. You know, my wife and my kids used to say to me, why are you like that? On the pitch, I just had an unbelievable desire to win, and we'd do it within the rules any which way I could, but I'm completely opposite off the pitch, as most people would tell you.
So when ex-Premier League or Championship adversaries bump in you on holiday, they can buy you an ice cream, have a chit-chat.
Absolutely.
Past the fact that
feel free to buy me anything you want.
Aha. And I can testify that not only did I come into this admiring Paul Dickov, I've come out of it admiring and liking him still more. We've been talking to a gent. That was the big interview with Paul Dickov. Paul,
thank you. Loved it.
Thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you.
So thank you to Mr. Paul Dickov for the interview. And for the off-microphone follow-up in Rincón de Rafa in the Deansgate, Manchester, that followed this podcast recording. Thank you also to all our friends at Manchester City, especially Alex Rowan in the media department. You can get an extra big interview, plus a documentary special every month, and hear all our content, advert-free, by signing up as a socio at patreon.com/GrahamHunter. For just £2.99 per month, you'll also know that you're supporting this show. Independent football podcasting, interviews like I hope you never heard before. Without you, we can't do it. Thank you to all our socios, our members. We need you in order to do this. Love and kisses.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
It's the question that's on everyone's mind. How do you live a good life? Is it about work, health, or relationships? What about happiness, meaning, and money? What really matters? And how can you dramatically improve all of these things? These are the questions we explore every week on the top-ranked podcast, Good Life Project, hosted by award-winning author and perpetual seeker, Jonathan Fields, which also happens to be me. Every week, I sit down with world-renowned researchers, experts, and scions of art and industry on the Good Life Project podcast. This week, in fact, we're sharing a fantastic conversation with the author Elizabeth Gilbert about a single practice that changed her life. Listen to the Good Life Project podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.